You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Lyndon Johnson's name will be forever linked with the landmark Civil Rights Act that he signed in 1964. But in his latest book, Todd S. Purdom tells the story of the group of lawmakers, many of whom have been largely forgotten, who worked across party lines for more than almost 2 years to get the landmark legislation through Congress. Todd Purdom is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and senior writer at Politico. His book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hi, Todd.
Hi, glad to be here.
You begin with President Kennedy's assassination on November 22, 1963, and the reaction of this story's key players to that event. Did many people think that the civil rights struggle and the atmosphere surrounding it had played a role in the assassination?
Well, I think initially there, some people did. Mrs. Kennedy herself was shocked to learn that Lee Harvey Oswald was a leftist pro-Cuba sympathizer. And she told the Attorney General Robert Kennedy that night at Bethesda Naval Hospital he didn't even have the satisfaction of being killed for civil rights. It had to be some silly little communist. Certainly the NAACP and others thought that the climate of what they considered the climate of hate that was abroad in the country had contributed to Kennedy's death.
Well, not all that much later, we had a number of civil rights leaders who were assassinated. Exactly. But in 63 had been a huge year for the struggle for civil rights. Martin Luther King had written the letter from Birmingham jail on Good Friday. There was the church bombing that killed three girls in Birmingham. Had the momentum for new legislation shifted over the course of the year?
Yes, I think over the course of the 6 months from spring to fall of 1963, the momentum decisively shifted. The demonstrations in Birmingham that spring when police dogs and fire hoses were trained on children, young people, they were knocked to the ground. That galvanized world opinion and President Kennedy, too.
And then that June, the integration of the University of Alabama became national news when Governor George Wallace confronted Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach. That evening, President Kennedy addressed the nation and proposed comprehensive civil rights legislation. Hadn't he been kind of reluctant to address civil rights in what he hoped would be just his first term?
He had been. He campaigned on a strong civil rights platform in 1960, and he won the black vote. But he was worried that getting too deeply immersed in civil rights legislation would derail his other priorities, including a big tax cut. But increasingly, as time went on, he began to see how much it was damaging the country. It was giving America a black eye in the Cold War, international relations. The Soviet Union delighted in talking about how much unrest and injustice there was in American society while we preached democracy abroad. So by the time of the integration of the University of Alabama, precisely because it had proceeded calmly, he decided that was the night to address the nation.
How did civil rights groups respond to the announcement?
Well, they were obviously, pleased. Most of the major civil rights groups thought it was not strong enough, that it was a little bit too little too late, that they were hoping for more robust legislation, particularly to protect against employment discrimination.
And weren't they already at work planning the March on Washington that would be held in August?
Yes, they were in the process of doing that. The first real serious planning meeting happened in July, but by late June, they decided to do it. And, of course, the Kennedy administration was terrified that it might turn violent, that there might be some untoward events. And eventually, when the president couldn't get what he thought was a satisfactory answer about who was in charge of logistics, he said, well, we'll be in charge of logistics then. And so the Justice Department basically from the organizational aspect of the march took it over in an effort to make sure that it would succeed. And it did.
And then on October 8, 1963, H.R. 7152, the bill that would become the Civil Rights Act, was introduced into the House Judiciary Committee. Who had written it?
It was written by the Justice Department, drafted by the Justice Department lawyers, a team under the direction of Robert Kennedy and his deputy, Nicholas Katzenbach, and the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Burke Marshall. And it was supported in the House Judiciary Committee by the chairman, New York's own Manny Seller, Emanuel Seller from Brooklyn. And the challenge there was Chairman Seller was an old-fashioned liberal Democrat, and he was under a lot of pressure from civil rights groups to make the bill stronger. So during the course of October, as the hearings went on, he allowed a number of amendments to be attached to the bill that in the eyes of some other civil rights supporter, including an interesting little-known figure now named William McCulloch, who was the ranking Republican member on the Judiciary Committee, that these amendments would have risked jeopardizing the bill's fate in the whole House and in the Senate.
He was a conservative Republican.
He was a conservative
Republican.
Today
he probably wouldn't have voted the same way.
Possibly, but the world that made him, he was descended from abolitionists in West Central Ohio. His district is now represented by John Boehner, in fact. He was fiscally conservative. He opposed federal aid to education. He opposed gun control. But he was a strong, unwavering supporter of civil rights. And in the view of Nick Katzenbach and others, he was probably the single most important influential person in the legislative debate in getting the law passed.
But he put two conditions on his support.
The first was that they would not, the Kennedy administration would promise not to trade away the bill, not to weaken it in the Senate, which had been the usual pattern with civil rights legislation. That's what Lyndon Johnson had done as majority leader in 1957 and 1960. And the second condition was that the Kennedy administration give the Republicans equal credit for the bill. And in return, McCulloch promised that as the ranking member and the point man on civil rights in the Republican caucus, he would bring along enough Republicans to pass the bill, which was very important because, remember, the Democrats, the Southern Democrats, were violently opposed.
And then Kennedy was assassinated.
Exactly.
Did that threaten the compromise?
I think no. In fact, it galvanized support for the bill even more in the aftermath of the assassination.
In an address to Congress 2 days after Kennedy's funeral, President Johnson said no memorial, oration, or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill. Was it important to link the president's legacy to the civil rights legislation in order to jumpstart progress?
I think Johnson felt it was important for him to come out strong and hard in saying, I'm going to finish the most important unfinished business that President Kennedy left behind. And that was a way for him to establish his bona fides, his credibility. Because remember, to much of the public who didn't know him very well, he was seen as a sort of maybe a tool of conservative Texas oil interests and not a progressive on these matters. People didn't understand how much his own views had evolved on civil rights.
Was it likely that the bill would not have passed if he hadn't pushed that hard?
Oh, I think if Johnson had ever wavered, if he'd ever said, I'm willing to deal and trade away provisions, I think it's very likely that a weaker bill would have resulted, if any bill at all.
Does it turn out that he might have been actually more keen on pushing the civil rights bill than Kennedy had been while Kennedy was alive?
Well, while Kennedy was alive in the spring of 1963, most memorably in a speech at Gettysburg on that Memorial Day of 1963, Johnson came out very strongly in favor of a bill and saying, we can't delay anymore. We've delayed 100 years. And in fact, it made the White House a little nervous that he was getting so far out there.
And that's one of the big surprises of Johnson's story, that a man from the South who had actually voted against civil rights legislation for part of his career in Congress would then become such an ardent supporter.
Yes, and he explained to Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, that part of his change in attitude was a result of the fact that he was the president of the whole country and no longer a representative from Texas or a senator from Texas. He described his feeling in the words of Martin Luther King, free at last, free at last.
My guest is Todd S. Purdom. His latest book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. How did McCulloch's name become pretty much lost in history?
Well, first of all, he was a very modest man. He did not seek the limelight. He just quietly went about his business. Second of all, the Republican reputation as being sort of the party of Lincoln, and for much of the 20th century, to the degree that any party paid attention to civil rights, it was the Republican Party. McCulloch retired from Congress in 1972. He died in 1980. By the time of his death, Ronald Reagan was in the process of being elected president. His first general election campaign appearance that year was at the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi, and he made really a sort of explicit appeal to white Southern Republicans. And the Republican Party was seen by that point in some ways as the party of white backlash, not as the party of civil rights.
Well, he helped get it pushed through the House. Was he worried that the Senate might not be as supportive?
He was worried. And as time went on and the filibuster in the Senate dragged on and the debate dragged on, Protests continued around the country, demonstrations, Martin Luther King in St. Augustine, Florida, among other places. And McCulloch worried that if the bill came back to the House, which would eventually have to be the case if so much as a word was changed, that the support in the House would be weakening and wavering. And he was very worried about the time that it took in the Senate.
Well, and the possibility that it would be watered down.
Exactly. And it was his insistence that it not be watered down that forced the Johnson administration to attempt something that had never before succeeded, which was to break the filibuster.
Did he have a good relationship with Emanuel Seller?
He did. They were very different in their views on certain issues, but they were close. Their wives were close. They socialized together. They were a kind of Mutt and Jeff. I mean, they couldn't have been more different in personality or outlook, but they were very close.
You mentioned the amendments that Seller allowed to be added to the bill. Do you think that he actually expected them to be on the final bill? Could they have been seen as bargaining chips that could be traded later on?
That's how he saw them. And again, that had been the traditional pattern. So, for example, he allowed an amendment that would have made the bill apply to state elections, not just federal ones, which is what the Kennedy administration initially proposed. And he thought that then some of these things could become bargaining chips in the Senate. But the problem is McCulloch had already secured a commitment from the administration that they would not bargain away things in the Senate. So Seller's strategy was really kind of already overtaken by events, and he didn't really quite understand that.
So the bill only applied to national elections, and there could still be discrimination on the local level?
Well, yes, and that's why effectively the following year they had to pass the Voting Rights Act to finish the job of access to the ballot that had not been really completed by the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Was that episode one of the reasons that you say that the civil rights supporters turned out to be the biggest threat during the process? Some of the amendments that they objected to in their quest for a pure bill?
Well, of course, they were the prime movers in getting any bill at all. And the classic reality is in life, as in law, in legislation, the perfect can sometimes become the enemy of the good. And that's what happened with some of the most ardent supporters of civil rights. They were so intent on taking the moment, getting this long-delayed law passed, that I think they often didn't understand that what was important was to get something strong passed, maybe not the perfect bill. And I think in hindsight, they all acknowledge that, you know, they got more than they ever dreamed possible in the end.
Another key figure is somebody whose name just is vaguely familiar to me, Charles Halleck, also a Republican congressman. What did he do?
He was the House Republican leader. He was the minority leader. He was from Indiana, small town boy like Bill McCulloch, also represented virtually no black constituents. But because McCulloch was the party's point man on civil rights, because he was the ranking member of the committee, Halleck had to respect him. In the custom of the day, you respected your committee chairs and ranking members. And because McCulloch was for it, Halleck was for it. And Halleck brought the Republican caucus along at some peril, at some price to his own political standing.
Well, in looking at this process, I'm, of course, thinking about what's going on today.
Indeed.
A lot of compromise here, a lot of trading. But what came out of it was a pretty decent bill.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure that something like that could happen in today's political climate.
I don't think it could happen for several reasons. One is a lot of the compromise and trading happened behind closed doors in private, where people could stake out positions that didn't have to be final. They didn't have to justify them on C-SPAN or the nightly news. They didn't have to play to the gallery or to their constituents. They could, you know, test the assumptions and see what might work. They also genuinely all knew and liked each other as people. They had many common experiences, either their service in the military or their, you know, coming of age in the Depression. And their wives and families and children knew each other. And it's easy to romanticize the Washington of long ago. But I think in that particular aspect, there really was more civility and more trust.
My guest is Todd S. Purdom. His book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is published by Henry Holt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Todd S. Purdom, who is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, senior writer at Politico, was at the New York Times for 20 years. He has written a book called An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, published by Henry Holt. This all happened before you got into journalism.
Indeed, it did. It makes me think I must have missed a kind of golden age in a way.
But what got you thinking about writing a book about this?
Well, my editor at Vanity Fair, a wonderful man and wonderful editor named Cullen Murphy, a few years ago, anticipating the anniversary, asked me if I'd ever thought about this topic. And the appeal of it seemed to be not only that it was so completely different than what's happening in Washington today, but that it might have instructive lessons for today. And also that it was an episode that has usually been a chapter or a section in somebody else's book and not a book of its own. And it seemed like a story that had a beginning and a middle and an end and would be a good thing to tell.
It's interesting that some of the leaders of this legislative effort, the ones you've been talking about, came from districts that were heavily white, often from the Midwest. Was the situation different in those days? Today, that would probably be a reason that they would not vote for something like this.
Yes, I think it's true. We have to remember the two parties were so different in those days. I mean, there were effectively three parties because the Democrats were split on questions of civil rights.
This is all before the Southern Strategy.
All before the Southern Strategy had come about. But one of the key constituent groups that was enlisted to lobby for the bill was a wide array of interdenominational, interfaith, religious groups who could bring pressure to bear on, say, a senator from one of the Dakotas or Nebraska who might not have many black constituents but had a lot of Methodists or Catholics. And in those days, organized religion, civil rights was a paramount issue and seen as a kind of a moral crusade in a way that it never has been since. And I think that was clearly a key to getting support for the bill in the Senate particularly.
Well, it passed the Judiciary Committee by a vote of 20-14. That's not all that close.
No, in the end, it wasn't that close. And I think the issue was, as so often with legislation, if you could get the critical mass to do it, then it would be done decisively. And what, for example, President Obama has paid such a terrible price with the Health Care Act is because he passed it so narrowly on strictly partisan lines. When the Civil Rights Bill finally passed the Senate, it passed 73-27 with 27 out of 33 Republican votes. So it was overwhelmingly passed, and no one could say it wasn't the law of the land.
Well, it moved to the House floor for debate on January 31st, 1964. Did it change much when it was put before the full House?
It didn't change too much. The most substantive, interesting change that happened actually was devised by a Southern segregationist named Howard Smith, the chairman of the Rules Committee, a representative from Virginia, and he proposed to include in the protected classes for employment discrimination sex. So this was horrifying to some people like Manny Seller, who thought it might jeopardize the bill because nobody wanted to protect women, for heaven's sake. In fact, it was passed. It became an accepted part of the law, and it revolutionized employment law, and that was a huge spur to the women's movement.
Although we are still fighting over that.
We're still
today.
Fighting these battles, indeed.
Then 11 days later, it was passed by the House by a vote of 290-130. And then sent to the Senate. Senate Majority Leader at that time was Everett Dirksen, and he was a kind of a moderate Republican.
Yes, he was the Senate Minority Leader, the Senate Republican Leader, and he was for the bill in general, but he had concerns about two sections, really the two most important sections. One was the Title II, the section that covered public accommodations, the desegregation of lunch counters, hotels, and the like. And the second was the employment discrimination title. And he came from Illinois, which already had strong anti-discrimination laws on the books, and he did not want businesses in Illinois to be beset by two sets of record-keeping, and he didn't want the federal government intruding on what he felt was the state prerogative.
So he proposed changes.
He proposed a series of changes, many of them picayune changes in language so that he could say he was proposing a large numerical number, but some of them substantive, including giving states like his that had these laws in place first crack at the problem before the feds would intervene.
How did Congressman McCulloch react to the changes that Dirksen made?
He was willing to accept those because, as he said later, they had a substantial effect in terms of drawing support of other Republicans while not really materially weakening the bill. But the Southerners understood exactly what was going on, and what was going on was it was going to make the bill apply to legal segregation in the South and basically leave unaddressed the question of de facto segregation in the North.
Now, as I remember it, Congress at that time was full of real characters.
Unbelievable characters.
But you described Dirksen as the single most flamboyant senator of his day. He's the one who made that famous, had that famous line about, what is it, $1 billion and another $1 billion, and it adds up to real money.
Yes, and his the library in Illinois that has his paper say they cannot find a definitive proof that he ever actually said that, but it certainly passed into history as something that he said, and it's what we journalists would say is too good to check. But he was an amazing character. He had an incredible mellifluous voice known as the Wizard of Ooze. He gargled every day with Pond's cold cream and water and swallowed it.
Well, another one of the key figures, Congressman Halleck, seemed to be gargling with something else.
Well, yes, both Senator Dirksen and Congressman Halleck liked the distilled spirits. They were not shy about drinking. They were not shy about drinking during the day. President Johnson told one of his aides, Larry O'Brien, that, well, you know, every time I talk to him, he's drinking. And O'Brien said, if you get him after lunch, that's one of the realities you have to deal with. So it was a different world.
And Hubert Humphrey, who was a senator, was named the Democratic floor manager for the bill?
Yes, and he had a long record on civil rights. As the mayor of Minneapolis in 1948, he had proposed a strong plank in the Democratic platform from the floor of the convention in Philadelphia. And against the wishes of the party elders, it passed. And he had this wonderful phrase about, to those who say we're rushing, I say we're 200 years too late. It's time to walk into the bright sunshine of human rights.
But it's interesting, he clashed with Johnson over tactics. And later, Johnson makes him his vice presidential running mate.
In a sense, Humphrey's management of this bill was one long audition for the vice presidency, and Johnson had to acknowledge that Humphrey had, in fact, done a very good job. Johnson wanted to run the Senate in round-the-clock sessions. He wanted to try to exhaust people. Humphrey and Mike Mansfield thought it would be more effective to let the Southerners have their day, have their say, let them basically talk themselves to death until all the arguments had been made, and the feeling was that then maybe the momentum would shift, and it did.
Well, Johnson had been a pretty effective Senate majority leader, so wouldn't he have known how to handle the Senate, or was it seen as kind of intrusive that the president was now acting a bit like the Senate
yes,
majority
leader? That's the key. The president could not be a senator and the president at the same time. And I think people in the Senate, when Lyndon Johnson first became vice president, he made a brief stab at continuing to asking to preside over the Democratic caucus in the Senate. And it was shot down. And he was very shocked by that.
So it was shot down by the Kennedys.
Well, no, it was shot down by his fellow senators. And he realized that he could not meddle too much or it would backfire. And so one of the things, I mean, in as you pointed out at the beginning of the program, in the sort of popular myth, the Civil Rights Act is seen as almost the single-handed work of President Johnson. I think it's just as remarkable that he held himself in check for such a strong-willed, impulsive person to avoid causing a backlash.
Todd S. Purdom is my guest. His book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 from Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another key figure is Richard B. Russell, Jr., the leader of the Senate Southern Bloc. He's from Georgia.
Yes.
And he would have been expected to be a strong opponent to this bill.
Yes, and he was. And he was making what was really amounted to the South's last stand. He knew that he probably could not prevail. He hoped he might be able to delay the bill, delay legislation. But he knew that the world was changing. And in a way, he made the stand he did so that at the end of the day, he could go home and say to the people of Georgia, we fought the good fight, we lost fair and square, and now we have to abide by the new law.
Well, he led a record-setting filibuster of 534 hours.
It's unbelievable in hindsight to think about how long the Senate was tied up. 50 years ago this week, it was nothing was going on but this debate.
So how did they get past the filibuster? Did they just run out of steam?
I think partly they ran out of steam. And Senator Dirksen summed up the feeling when he quoted, paraphrased something that Victor Hugo once said, which is that stronger than all the armies is an idea whose time has come. And, of course, you could argue that this idea was 100 years too late. The Civil War was supposed to have solved this problem. But I think there was widespread feeling, not just in the Congress, but in the country at large, that, oh, my goodness, we have to do something about this problem.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how many days 534 hours is.
I should know.
It's got
to
be.
Cheat.
It sounds. Let's
it
see.
Was the better part of 3 months. I mean, it was. Yeah. It was really all of April, all of May, and up to June 19th. So
something like
June
20, 10th. Yeah, yeah. 20 days or something like that. Incredibly long. Meanwhile, okay, so Congress is arguing over this, but the rest of the country is watching it. Was there a big debate outside of Congress?
Yes, there was. Religious groups came to Washington in droves to hold prayer vigils. They had round-the-clock vigils at the Lincoln Memorial during the debate. It was consuming the newspapers. It also became one of the first big running stories in television news. Roger Mudd of CBS was planted outside the Senate every day giving updates.
I can't imagine that sort of thing happening today.
No, it's hard to imagine.
I'm talking about from religious groups.
Yeah,
as
no,
well.
It's hard to imagine that there would be that kind of galvanic participation by grassroots groups in some legislative debate.
So it passed the Senate by a vote of 73-27. The 27 were mostly Southern Democrats?
Mostly Southern Democrats. Six Republicans joined them.
Do we know why? Were they from the South? Or?
Well, John Tower was from Texas, so he was from the South. The others had various arguments about private property. The most prominent opponent was Barry Goldwater, getting ready to become his party's presidential nominee. And he worried that the public accommodation section would interfere with the rights of private property owners to serve whom they pleased and create a kind of big brother mentality. And indeed, that came out of the libertarian streak that years later he would display when he said so famously he didn't oppose having gays in the military because it didn't matter whether you were straight as long as you could shoot straight. It's sort of the same sentiment, and he paid a price for it, and the party paid a price for it too,
because it was hung on him
exactly.
Over the years.
Yeah.
Although the bill was signed into law, the struggle for civil rights was far from over. When President Johnson signed the bill, the search for the bodies of the three civil rights workers who had been killed in Mississippi in late June was still going on.
It is, and that's one of the things until I started this research, Leonard, that I didn't really realize quite how cheek by jowl and chock-a-block all these events came. They were swirling around, you know, while whatever was happening in Washington, there were all kinds of events happening in the country. It's almost unimaginable the pressures that President Kennedy and President Johnson must have been under.
But you also have to wonder whether the reaction, the killing of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner wouldn't have happened if people, the zealots on the other side, weren't so angered by what
was
happening.
It's definitely true. I mean, the people in the South saw this bill as very provocative indeed, and there was a backlash against it. Some businesses closed rather than comply with it. And, of course, we're still fighting over some aspects of it today.
Well, last year the Supreme Court ruled that the formula for the Voting Rights Act, which mandates advance approval for the changes in voting laws in states with a history of discrimination, was outdated.
Yes. And in 2012, campaigning for the Senate in Kentucky, Rand Paul said he thought that the Title II of the Civil Rights Act, the one mandating non-discrimination in public accommodations, might well be unconstitutional.
What about the Voting Rights Act? That was passed the following year. Was it pretty much the same coalition that got that one passed?
It was the same coalition, especially very much the same mix of Dirksen in the Senate and McCulloch in the House that got that passed. And that was really these two bills were the high watermark of cooperation on this issue. And really, as the 60s went on, the consensus began to splinter and was never the same again.
Is there some irony in the fact that Dirksen and Russell are probably best known today because of the congressional office buildings that have been named after them?
Yes, indeed. I mean, they're honored as sort of edifices, but they're not spoken of in the same breath. I mean, Lyndon Johnson said that Dirksen deserved to be as well known as Abraham Lincoln, and that's certainly not the case.
No. Or Russell, for that matter. No, there have been many more distinguished members of Congress. Why those two?
Why were that? Why the buildings named for them? Partly because they died at the right time. They were building a third Senate office building, and there was a move to name that after the late Phil Hart of Michigan. And so I think they were just in the right place at the right time.
You note that after the two bills were passed, the consensus on civil rights would never be as strong as it was then. What changed? Did the issues surrounding discrimination and equality become much more complicated as they became about busing, affirmative action, the rise of the Black Power movement?
Yes, that is what happened.
The Vietnam War?
And the Vietnam War drove a total wedge in the coalition that had supported the bill. And by the time of Dr. King's assassination, for example, he and Lyndon Johnson weren't really even speaking.
We talk about how there's very little sense of bipartisanship today, but have we seen this kind of bipartisanship since the mid-60s?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think at various times you've seen it on questions. You know, it wasn't so long ago that immigration was a kind of a bipartisan issue, or for that matter, renewal of the Voting Rights Act as recently as 6 or 7 years ago was a bipartisan issue. It's only been in the last particularly in the last decade, that there's been such intense polarization over these questions. And I think we're at, you know, all the studies by the analysts show we're at a level not seen since the Reconstruction era.
And then we have the same split in the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And we didn't during the Warren years and the years that followed. No matter who was Chief Justice, there seemed to be a lot more cooperation than there is today.
Yes, we have a narrowly divided country and a narrowly divided government, and I think we seem to be condemned to have that for some time to come.
Do we know whether the men who worked to pass the Civil Rights Act considered it one of their highest achievements or their highest achievement?
Yes, I think they did all to a person considered it that. And I was lucky enough to find a dwindling number of their former aides who are all, you know, by definition in their 80s or 90s now. And to a person, they all regarded this, and many of them were in their late 20s at the time, as the single most meaningful and important thing they did in their lives, and they're very proud of it to this day.
Todd S. Purdom's book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard. A pleasure to be here.